I'm Jairus. I'm here to talk to you about Mozilla's Internet Health Report. I have three cats. This is Inky, Blinky, and Clyde. They're very good cats, except for Blinky. Blinky's not very good at being a cat or very smart, but she has a good heart. So I think that's important. This is me and Clyde playing Monster Hunter. So you can find me online at JairusCon. I'm JairusCon basically everywhere. So Twitter, Instagram, Xbox Live, PlayStation Network. If you have very bad taste in music, you might also have heard my music. It's not very good. I can't recommend it. But it was mentioned by JWZ, so some of you may have read about it. I did a kind of a protest at a show that I was playing, so that was a whole thing. It was pretty good. I work for Mozilla. Probably you know it. We make Firefox. We have Pocket, a bunch of other stuff too. I work for the Mozilla Foundation, which is the nonprofit arm of Mozilla. It owns the Mozilla Corporation that makes Firefox and everything else. And part of what the Mozilla Foundation tries to do is look at ways that we can make the internet better, that we can make it safer, we can make it more engaging, more inclusive, everything. Mozilla works on there's a Mozilla manifesto with a number of principles about why Mozilla operates the way that it does. And it's not open source just because it's a good idea and makes good software, but also because we're trying to make things better overall. So these are some of the principles that Mozilla operates under. And I'm going to talk just for a few seconds about some of the other stuff Mozilla's doing. Not to sell you on Mozilla, but just to give you some context for why we're doing the Internet Health Report and what it means. So we put a lot of resources into not just our own projects, but in projects by other people to try and uplift work other people are doing. Right now, there's an application process open for $250,000 towards artists who are making art exploring AI. It's still open. You can apply for it. We also do fellowships. Last year, we did over $1 million in fellowships for open web activists, tech policy professionals, people who are doing work that is useful and should be seen by more people. So if you are doing interesting work, head to the Mozilla Foundation website. Maybe we can give you a lot of money. That'd be great. We also do a bit of consumer advocacy. So one of the projects we had at the end of last year was called Privacy Not Included, where we took a bunch of popular toys that were smart toys that were connected, and we ran them through security audits to try and figure out what could go wrong. If this toy got hacked, what could go wrong? I chose this one because I think this cat is definitely a Fed. Look at those eyes. Those are dead inside. Those are like shark eyes. So this is like an audit of this real toy called PetCube Play. It says there's a camera, there's a mic, it tracks your location, you have to have an account, it does have privacy controls. So this work is to look at health of the internet a bit differently. When Mozilla started going deeper into this advocacy kind of work, there was kind of a realization that we've been approaching it the wrong way. We've been spending our time telling people to install VPNs and use Tor and worry about IoT. And then we did a survey and some research and realized most people have no idea what these things are. And really what you have to say is your pet toy spying on you? And the answer is maybe, which is weird, but that's life in the year 2018. In the 60s, environmentalists had a bit of a problem in that there were all of these issues that were really, really important that they were trying to talk about, that they didn't know how to get traction on. You know, you had holes in the ozone layer, you had renewable energy, animal conservation, all of these things that were being discussed and looked at individually. And at some point, it coalesced around a movement, an environmental movement. So these things, it's not about saving the whales, it's not about deforestation, it's not about the ozone layer, it's about all of these things, when put together, create stress on this global system, the system of systems we call the environment. And it can maybe support more stress in one place than another, but it's a full system and we need to look at it as an ecosystem And it was effective. So laws were changed, green industries were created, and now we all kind of generally understand that the environment means something. When we talk about the health of the environment, it means something. We're at a similar place now with the internet. So that is, over there, by the way, this is all the websites that can only use Internet Explorer 6 that are still around. But the internet has become our environment. We have apps to help us with everything, with eating, walking, driving, growing food, having sex, having a baby, not having a baby, building widgets, running a city. And the Internet of Things is going to have 20 billion devices on it by 2020. They're all going to be collecting data, and they're of questionable security. So the stakes are different now. The internet is our environment, and how healthy it is or isn't has a direct impact on our happiness, our privacy, our pocketbooks, everything. So we are trying to frame the internet conversation differently. It's not about packet latency. It's not about IPv6 uptake. It's not about harassment. It's about internet health, and all of these things play a part. It's an environment, it's a network of networks, and it can absorb more stress on some places than others, but we can't look at these things in isolation anymore. So that brings us to the Internet Health Report. There are a lot of reports about the internet, about the way that it works in different countries, levels of censorship, level of network penetration. We're trying to do something a bit different in that it is about the human experience of the internet. So we're trying to look at it from the level of the internet is a network, but at the end of all these data points are people. The internet is built so that people can use it. So what is it doing for people? Is it useful for people? And if the system isn't healthy, if it's unhealthy, can you have healthy communities built on a system that's unhealthy? So we worked with researchers, digital rights activists, our community, randos on Twitter, anyone who wanted to help. It's an open source project to look at, from a human perspective, how the internet is. So we looked at five issues that after research we felt like were the best categories for discussing it. We also had three spotlight stories that that were issues that were extremely pressing that maybe covered a couple of these different categories. One being centralization, how big internet companies are getting, and how it creates unhealthy conditions for innovators, smaller populations trying to get online. Fake news, and looking at it not just from a state propaganda point of view, but what is the impact fake news is having on people on the internet, and why is it, why does it work? And the third is IoT, which, as mentioned, is, we're adding more devices, we're not adding more security, probably that's not going to work out well for us. So I'm going to talk a bit about some of the things in each of these categories that we looked at. So the first category is privacy and security. These are some of the stories that we had. We have a problem with security in that the core business models of the internet depend on knowing as much as possible about everyone and then analyzing, repackaging, and selling that information. 2017 was a really bad year for security. There were breaches everywhere, Equifax. Yahoo announced that over a billion accounts had been breached. I didn't even know there were a billion Yahoo accounts, but Uber, it was everywhere. WannaCry happened. So it was a bad year for security overall. One of our stories here is about Rami Rauf. He's an Egyptian technologist. He was working out of Lebanon. He's a member of the Tor board of directors. And he was working in the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, which is an NGO. When they get a call from a journalist about a press conference that they were going to be having soon, they hadn't planned a press conference, so this was news. And upon investigation, they found that hundreds of emails had been sent out in the organization's name, inviting journalists, activists, civil society groups to a press conference that they never arranged about a draft law in Egypt that would effectively ban non-governmental organizations. The law passed. It's a disaster. Human Rights Watch says, the law ushers in unprecedented levels of repression and will criminalize the work of many NGOs, making it impossible for them to function independently. And as part of the rollout for this law, a lot of NGOs found themselves under a reasonably sophisticated technical and social attacks. There was a paper published on this along with the Citizen Lab from U of T. The scale of attacks was called the Nile Fish. But these are some of the challenges facing people when they are trying to do activist work, when they are trying to work on internet health. This is a classic, one of my favorites. So this is from a leak of 10 million passwords. WP Engine took one of the 10 million password leaks that were floating around, put together top common use passwords. I'm sure none of us would use any of these, of course. But it shows how bad passwords are as a form of security, and how even now, 123456, people are like, oh, that's a good idea. That's what I should use for my password. So, you know, these are live, these are real. It was estimated by the researcher that put this together that 16 out of 1,000 passwords could be guessed using the top 10. So the next topic we did was openness. One of the great things about the internet is you don't need permission to build for it. There's permissionless innovation. And the idea of that openness is built into the architecture of the internet. You know, to a level where now we're trying to kind of bake more security into the fundamental protocols. But that openness of the internet is a radical concept. It was a radical concept when it was invented, and it's constantly at risk. Governments block mobile apps, shut down the internet at will. Copyright laws, as mentioned in one of the sessions earlier, are a real threat to free speech. So how open the internet is a good bellwether for how healthy it is in a lot of places. This is a chart for official justifications for government shutdowns of the internet. So this is when a government has intervened in either, at the border or with state ISPs or with private ISPs forced shutdowns of internet services. You can see in 2017, the national security justification is about twice as big as it was the year before, along with stopping rumors and dissemination of legal content. The majority of shutdowns last year occurred in Asia and Africa, with the idea that they were preventative responses to conflicts. In some places, these shutdowns lasted hours. In some places, they lasted months. And minorities are disproportionately at the end of these, whether that's an ethnic or linguistic minority, whether that's people who don't have access to higher tier services. Shutdowns disproportionately affect the marginalized the most. And obviously, they're bad for the internet. They contribute to the balkanization of the internet, and we need better legal frameworks for when something happens that there is a justification that we need to impact internet traffic. We need to have a framework for it. We need to be able to examine it and hold it up to the light and say, no, that we think this is important. And those frameworks don't really exist yet. The next category we looked at is digital inclusion. So that's who's online? About half the world's population is online now. And like with the shutdowns, the digital divide is greater for marginalized populations. So rural communities, low incomes, women, minorities have worse access, are connected later, and have fewer accesses to the same services once they're online. So the internet is great if you're on it. So we need to look at who's on it, is it safe to be on it, and what the impact of that is. One of the stories that we did is about the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, which is a helpline for victims of revenge porn, which is when someone takes your intimate images and shares them without your knowledge or consent. This is a big problem. Not just this, but harassment in general is a big problem because it's kicking people off the internet. People are going offline. They're saying, you know what, I can't do this. And this is a speech issue, in addition to a safety issue, because the people who aren't online anymore can't participate in the digital commons. There was a Supreme Court ruling last year about a law that prevented convicted sex offenders from accessing using social networking websites. And it was struck down in a unanimous ruling, and I'm going to put a quote up here that I think is really, really important. While in the past there may have been difficulty in identifying the most important places for the exchange of views, today the answer is clear. It is cyberspace, the vast democratic forms of the internet in general, and social media in particular. So being able to be on social media is a speech issue. Being able to access these services and do so without getting doxxed, without getting harassed, without getting threats, without having the address of your kid's school posted, that's a speech issue. And when people are getting kicked offline, that's a problem. A common argument against this is that things like the First Amendment don't apply to private actors. They're intended to restrict the government's actions. And while that is true, the rights still exist. You don't get rights from governments. You get rights because you have rights. And when we started this whole internet, modern internet thing, I mean, the general feeling was we don't want the governments online, right? This is from J.P. Barlow's Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace. This is the opening line, opening lines of it. So the idea that threats to speech from private actors or from company are not actually an infringement of rights is a really radical retelling of the story of what the politics of the internet have always been, and is not really super accurate. The internet is a community that we are building, and if we allow people to chase other people off of it, that's a speech issue as much as if we are passing laws preventing them from being on it. The only difference is it's not the government that's shutting down your right to free speech. Everyone knows the phrase, my right to swing my fist ends where your nose begins. And we do a lot of talking here in other spaces and everywhere about swinging our fists. And not so much about where people's noses are. And as someone with a big nose, I feel personally affronted by this. But we don't really talk about, okay, so where does your right to free speech end when it comes to my right to be safe, to not be doxxed, to not be threatened? And this is something that we really need to grapple with, because we haven't done it yet. Web literacy is the next category that we looked at. This is complicated. You need a lot of skills to use the internet. A lot of technical skills and a lot of social skills. We did a study, Mozilla did a study, it was a one-year research project in Kenya, where we created a digital skills observatory. And this was a proper study. There were researchers, there was a control group, and it was to look at the impact of digital skills on people's lives. So it was a study cohort of 150 first-time smartphone users. They'd never had a smartphone before. People between the ages of 18 and 35, living in urban, rural areas that earned less than $5 a day. And it turned out they needed 53 skills in order to use the internet in a way that was safe, that improved their lives, that made it better. And that's a wild number. And I think that in the West especially, we have this idea that we know how the internet works, that there are such things as digital natives. If you put a baby in front of an iPad, they'll know how to use the internet. And we do have a lot of intuitive interfaces, and those are important. But I think that having spent so much time with the internet, like most of us in the room, we assume that what we've learned to be true is obvious. We know that if we get an email from John Q. Billionaire offering to transfer us money or some print somewhere, that like probably there's no billionaire offering to transfer us money. That's not a good idea. But for someone who's coming up to the internet now, I mean, they go on Twitter. The Pope is on Twitter. Donald Trump is on Twitter. Elon Musk, an actual billionaire, is on Twitter calling people names, right? Like this is real life. So when someone goes online now, they're a new user to the internet, they see Elon Musk like shit posting, and then they get an email from some other billionaire. That's not a crazy idea. It's not crazy that a billionaire could be talking to you directly. And if you want any more proof that we are not immune to this in the West, all we need to do is look at the issue of fake news, right? Which is kind of like the scam email, but for your relatives that you can't talk to anymore. So one of the things about the fake news issue that happened around the election last year, or 2 years ago, there was obviously a state propaganda element to it that everyone knows about. But prior to the election even, a number of journalists had done research into, okay, where are these stories coming from? Some are obviously coming from state propaganda, but they're not all coming from that. And where are they coming from? And the answer was really surprising. This is Veles in Macedonia, population 43,000, and responsible for hundreds of fake news sites, like literally hundreds of fake news sites. The reason that this happened is because people found in this economically depressed area where the average monthly income is between $400 and $500 US, that when they would post stories with, you know, wild headlines to Facebook, to Twitter, people would click on them and they would get advertising revenue. So they started making more stories. They got more advertising revenue. They started buying ads for it. And soon there was an economy in this very tiny town to create fake news, because people were making bank from it. Some people were making $10,000 US a month, which is a lot of money for anyone, let alone someone who lives in a place where, like, jobs are scarce and money more so. The reason that a lot of these fake news sites ended up being on one side of the political spectrum is because they performed better. That's it. People clicked, ads paid, more articles were written. So the impact that something like this has on the internet, on our ability to trust what we see on the internet, obviously is huge. Not even counting the political implications of it, but when you see something on the internet, do you have the skills to know if it's true or not? And how long did it take you to develop them? It's a big challenge. Decentralization is the last category that we looked at. So this is, people have talked about maybe we should break up big tech companies. Maybe it's not great if Facebook does everything for you. Probably that's true. But the fact that these services are becoming so tightly knit is a huge, huge problem. Pop quiz. What social media companies, or what companies have the most users on their social media networks? Top three. Yell it out if you have an idea. Facebook. WeChat, absolutely. So Tencent, which owns WeChat, is the number two social media company just behind Facebook. Facebook has WhatsApp, Messenger, Instagram. But Tencent, their user rate is huge. Who here knows about WeChat, is familiar with WeChat? All right, so quite a few of you. So one thing I think that's really interesting about WeChat is how they've managed to make QR codes like a fundamental part of social interactions. I like that they made them cute. So these are my QR codes from WeChat. If you're not familiar with WeChat, you have the ability to take a photo of a QR code and go to a website or load an app. And people use it to send money. So if I'm running a coffee shop, I can put my QR code up, and instead of giving me money, you can take a photo of my QR code and send me $4 for your coffee. So WeChat makes it, you know, cute and cool. And, you know, I can print these and have them on stickers. People get temporary tattoos. It's pretty cool. And in an increasingly cashless society in larger cities, the homeless are laminating their QR codes and keeping them out. That way they can get money too when people are carrying around less cash. WeChat has an 80 to 90% weekly penetration rate among active internet users in China. Like 9 out of 10 people. That's a lot of people. If you don't know WeChat, it's hard to understand the scale of it. It is, to a lot of people, the whole internet. You don't need to leave it. You can do almost anything on it. You can send money to friends, you can book a doctor's appointment, apply for a visa, donate to charities. You can't transfer 6.41 around the Tiananmen Square massacre. There's a lot of things you can't do on it. So WeChat is becoming more and more integrated into people's lives. WeChat is becoming more and more an offline thing as well as an online thing. In the top left here is a gas station. It's a WeChat gas station. You drive in. It scans your license plate. It loads your preferences. It knows what kind of gas that you want. So you just pull up. Everything's ready. Someone pumps your gas, and you drive away. And it charges your WeChat account. It's pretty cool. It's pretty fast. In the left, top left corner, is a screenshot of a facial recognition program that's being rolled out into WeChat, because WeChat is being used now in pilot programs as official government ID. So instead of a social security card or a social credit card, you have your WeChat. So you go to a government office, you go to a hospital, you show your WeChat ID and you get it to facial to recognize your face, and that counts as government ID. The big image in the middle here is an actual image from Chinese state media, because if it didn't exist and I made it up, no one would believe. They'd be like, that's ridiculous. So they're using facial recognition and machine learning to find jaywalkers. If you jaywalk at certain intersections, your face goes up on a website of jaywalkers. And now that people have their WeChat's account connected, you can get an automatic fine when you jaywalk. So you jaywalk, it scans your face. Your face is connected to WeChat. You get your WeChat's connected to your bank account or your WePay account, and you get a fine automatically. Within 10 months of deployment, over 13,000 jaywalkers had their faces displayed on LED or LCD screens next to the intersection to shame people who were jaywalking. So when we look at what centralization means, it's not just Google is using my emails to serve me better ads. Like the future of centralization is a Black Mirror episode that got cut for being too unrealistic. All of this is getting tied into the pilot and rollout of the Chinese social credit system. If you're not familiar with it, it's a system that China is hoping to roll out to all citizens by 2020, where you have a credit score that is your social credit score. So it includes financial things, same as your credit score here, but also how well you are participating and contributing to society. So higher credit score means you're a better citizen, basically. The exact magic juice of the credit score is not known, and it's still in pilot. So some of these will get added, some of them will get removed. But on the left, you can see some of the factors for credit scores, such as, do you pay your traffic fines on time? Do you spread online rumors? What do you buy? Do you play too many video games? If you play over a certain amount of hours, that can lower your score. On the right are some of the privileges you can get for having a good social credit score. So at the lower ones, you can get a loan to do online shopping, rent a car without deposit. And up at the top, you can get a fast-tracked visa. You can get access to social groups online that are women only, or men get access, I should say, to the women only groups as a kind of perk. My favorite of the factors here at the bottom is the Supreme People's Court's list of dishonest people, which is an actual thing that the Chinese Supreme Court publishes. The most recent list has 8.8 million names on it. So these are people who have defaulted on loans, who have been charged with, you know, perjury or similar crimes. If you're on this list, life is a lot harder for you. People on this list have been prevented from buying plane tickets. 8.7 million airline tickets have been declined because people were on this list. 3.4 million high-speed rail tickets. One person on this list was fined $15,000 for traveling on a first-class flight. They weren't allowed to because they were on the list. And another went, had plastic surgery to try and avoid the facial recognition. It did not work. 170,000 people have been denied executive job positions because they are on this list. So if it didn't exist and we made it up, people would be like, oh, that's ridiculous. If you call someone who is on this list, depending on how bad their offense is, you might get a phone message before they pick up saying the person you're talking to isn't paying their debts. Please convince them to do so. So all of this is getting integrated now with the social credit system. My favorite, actually, is not the Supreme Court's list of dishonest people. My favorite factor of the credit score is Counter-Strike. So Counter-Strike Go in China is hooked up to your official ID. If you want to play it, you have to connect it. If you use aimbots, your score gets lowered. It impacts your social credit score. This is the VP who brought Counter-Strike Go to China saying proudly, it's the worst punishment in history. And he's probably not wrong. So to kind of like roll this back a bit, this means that if you are using an aimbot when you play Counter-Strike, you might not get approved for a home loan. You might not be able to rent a car. You might not be able to fly, to go on vacation. This is what centralization looks like. People with low ratings can have slower internet speeds. Their speeds can get throttled, restricted access to restaurants, nightclubs, restricted access for luxury travel. It impacts your rental applications, ability to get a loan, social security benefits. People with low scores have limited ability to get hired. Even dating apps will show people scores if they have good scores. Which is a subtle effect, but what we're really looking at now is the way that you talk online, the way you play games online is going to impact who you meet, who you talk to, where you can go, the jobs that you can have, everything. And where you can go to school. So obviously, when we look at the West at our centralization, we need to be tougher about it because this is where we could end up. And that's not like, I mean, this isn't science fiction. The difference is that it's not going to be coming from the state. It's going to be coming from a bunch of companies that have gotten together and decided that, well, we want to lower your insurance rates if you are a good driver. So we're going to hook up to the telemetry of your car or some auto data collection site to see what you're doing. This is, this could be us. So all of this to say, it isn't about WeChat. It's not about China. It's about this system of systems we call the internet and how healthy it is or isn't. How healthy is the internet? It's not an easy question to answer. In some places, it's great. There are some indicators that look good: access, affordability, encryption. All of those things are moving in the right direction. Some things are definitely moving in the wrong direction: censorship, online harassment, energy use. The impact of Bitcoin mining on energy use is significant and is not going away. It's getting worse. We need to pay attention to the contractions that are happening online, tension between free speech and harassment. Technologies that have a lot of promise, like blockchain, that are also being used in ways that could be really, really bad for the entire planet. We need to examine how we can use the internet in a way to make everyone's lives better. So part of the work that we're doing at Mozilla is we're trying to get as many people involved in helping us figure out what we should be looking at for the Internet Health Report. We have a workshop session after next in the Paris room. If you are a person who works on these issues or is interested in these issues or has hoped someone would look into a particular issue but no one has, please come hang out, please talk to us. We really want to understand the issues that we don't understand. We want to know our unknown unknowns, and we want to get people together who care about these things to meet each other and to build those relationships that's going to let us fix it as much as we can. So if this is interesting to you, please come do this thing. If you can't make it, cool. I'm going to be here all weekend. Come say hi. And also, you can ping me on Twitter. You can ping me over email. And please check out the report. Let us know what you think. If you think it's terrible, cool, let us know. If you think it's good, also cool, let us know. It's the end of my presentation, so I think we have some time for Q&A.
Hello.
Hi.
So my question relates to, I wanted you to expound a little bit on the whole right of the fist and hitting your nose and whatnot.
Sure.
Because we're talking about people getting, having their speech rights, it sounds like you're saying people are having their speech rights limited,
yeah,
or, you know, not by the government, but, you know, socially, by other people who appear to be exercising their speech rights in some cases. And so I want to understand a little better, like, if you say that people who wear plaid shirts should be punched in the face, and, you know, I'm wearing a plaid shirt,
right,
then which one of us has to get off the internet? And,
right,
like, can you kind of, like, are you, and do you have some prescription or suggestion that you found around that?
So there was a case in the U.S., a Supreme Court case, I think in 2010. I think the case is Doe v. Reed, and in that case, it was about whether something to the effect of either voter registration lists or donors to political organizations, whether those could be kept secret or whether they could be published. And one of the things that the court found is that a way to tell whether it was okay to publish these lists or not is whether it would open up the people on the lists to harassment from private parties. Because if the government publishing these lists meant that private parties would threaten and harass, then that meant those parties' rights to speech was being infringed, and therefore the government couldn't do it. So I think that from a legal point of view, it's a gray area as far as what constitutes enough threat or enough harassment that someone's free speech rights are being infringed on. But when we share this commons, when we go online, when we have things like Twitter, the freedom to say things and to be present in those spaces is a right. If you said something unpopular and a news anchor that evening did a story on you and was like, his children go to school at this address, wouldn't be a shame if something happened to them, I think you would agree that, like, that is an infringement, like, on your right to speech. If you have powerful entities that are non-governmental threatening you, threatening your kids, doxing your house, or swatting your house, that impacts your ability to do those things. The fact that it's not the government doesn't mean that those rights don't exist or that they're not being infringed. It just means we don't have, you know, 200 or 500 years of legal precedent to look at for guidance. But if you care about free speech, you have to care about the speech of people who are not safe when they talk, even if it's from other people exercising their free speech.
Hi, I wanted to thank you for this the helpful talk. And I know you raised a lot of important issues. I don't want to detract from anything you said, but I do want to say something that I think is relevant about my experience using Mozilla products. So my experience is that when I use Mozilla products, it keeps defaulting me to Google search engine with sending keystrokes to Google. Mm-hmm. And when I go to work and I use Firefox, it gets re-imaged, the machine I use gets re-imaged every day, so it's, and then of course sysadmins are incompetent, so it gets put back to a Firefox image with terrible privacy settings, and Mozilla makes it very difficult to change the privacy settings, well not very, but unnecessarily difficult. You have to reboot Firefox if you want to change several things and so on. And I feel like my experience dealing with Mozilla is this organization is focusing on delivering to me a standards compliant browser, which is not at all what I want. I want a scraper, damn it. I'm not pretending that's going to help with everything you're talking about, but I just want to say that even though your points are very important, there does seem to be a significant amount more that Mozilla could be doing differently than it does now. And maybe your model of what users want, the idea that users want a standard compliant browser all the time and they don't necessarily want to make it easy, Mozilla isn't making it easy for users to make more of a scraper. I think that Mozilla might want to rethink that because Mozilla is not for profit. It doesn't have to say, well, we don't think there's a market for this. It can lead the way some. So right. Please do. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. I think that, I mean, obviously, I don't work in Firefox product development. I do know that people generally who work at Mozilla work there, you know, at the risk of sounding glib, because they want to change the world. Mozilla tries to put its money where its mouth is. We quit advertising on Facebook earlier in the year because we felt like their default policies weren't what we considered to be good for their users. And you know, the reason that your search defaults to Google is so that Mozilla can make money to do all of this work, right? Over 95 or something like that percent of Mozilla's entire revenue comes from things like search engine referrals. So at the end of the day, it needs to be self-sustaining, but I can promise you that the people who set those features and who set those defaults are doing it in a way that they feel is best for the users from a security point of view. And if you feel like there's a better way that they could be doing it, I think that that they would be receptive to hear it.
Hi. Thanks for the interesting talk. Back to the WeChat thing. One of the things I was thinking about is a lot of folks I've talked to in the Silicon Valley have been seeing things going on in China and the growth of WeChat and the growth of that industry within China. And my feeling is like it's been almost like it's been supported by the government. And here you see, like in this example, the WeChat is becoming like a state ID. Like there's no, doesn't seem to be a separation of like the large corporations from the governments. So the question is like us here in our society here, what can we really do to sort of keep this sort of thing from coming into, you know, into our side of it, with things like Facebook being like so large and stuff? I mean, what kind of things can we do?
Well, I think that it's different in the West because in the West, honestly, governments don't want to get into it. Governments are largely not actually interested in pursuing that level of scrutiny and control. And that might sound naive, but there was actually a DARPA project maybe 7-8 years ago that proposed a lot of what ended up being the same mechanisms that Cambridge Analytica relied on, that was proposed and shut down because the government felt they were not in the business of doing that kind of data collection, that kind of work on their own citizens. So what's happened is the private sector has done it for them. So I don't think that in the West, the problem we need to worry about is governments getting in bed with Facebook to get access to this data. I think that it's everyone else. I think it's political campaigns. I think it's, you know, banks, insurance, anyone who has realized that when you have this much information and you have sites like Facebook or Twitter or any of these places that are almost entirely funded by advertising, by knowing things about you, those sites are behavior modification machines. You go on them. Facebook makes money by you clicking on an ad. Facebook figures out, how do we make this person more likely to click on ads? And some of that is nice in that they will show you fewer stories that you don't like. They'll show you more stuff from your friends that'll keep you on the site longer. But at the end of the day, it is changing the way you behave on it so it can make more money. So I think that part of the way we protect against that kind of future here is by, from a legal point of view, looking at laws that protect data. The GDPR is a good example of laws that have really spent a lot of time thinking about what's involved in someone's data getting transferred from one entity to another. What is the right of a user to say, delete everything you have on me? And if we can extend that kind of thinking and those kind of protections to Silicon Valley, I think that we'd be in a much better position.
Hi. So a lot of people here work for very big companies, and of course it's our job to speak up in meetings and try to prevent our companies from doing things that would harm internet health. But what are examples of ways that employees of big companies can try to convince those companies to use their vast resources for ways that would improve internet health?
Unionize. That's answer number one. I think we only have time for one more question. I think that in tech, we have this idea that a lot of tech companies are a meritocracy, and we got to where we were because we're very good at what we do. And often that is true. But the reality is that as individuals, we do not really have the ability to leverage our views and demands on the companies that we work with because we are individuals. And the way that you change that is unionizing. If you have a union of workers, if everyone at Facebook was unionized and the Facebook union went to the Zuck and was like, we go on strike if you do this, they wouldn't do it. So I think that's honestly the best way to approach that. Any other questions? I know that there was a lineup before, so I think, we have one more, but come to me after, say hi, come to the workshop, happy to chat more. Last question.
Back to WeChat real quick. Have we seen any corporate conglomerates or Western companies already try to implement some of the features that we're seeing in China now?
I mean, I think that Facebook pays a lot of attention to what WeChat is doing when it comes to getting people to see it as part of their daily lives and not just a website that they go to. I don't think that there are any other sites that are just individual sites as compared to like an ecosystem, the Google ecosystem, that are thinking about it the same way Facebook is. And I think in part that's because a lot of the companies look at it and say that isn't actually the future that we want. But I don't think we're really seeing it over here yet. Okay, thank you so much. And come see us at 6:00.